Imagine a great procession this morning. At the head of this great line stands one that they call Master. You recognize him because he's carrying a cross. If you look very closely, you will see in his hands and in his feet holes that were made by the nails that fastened him to that tree. Look farther and see the great line that follows him. Thousands, millions upon millions. They are different in many respects. They come from every part of the world. They are all physical descriptions. They speak different languages. They lived in different times. But they all have one thing in common. There is no exception to the last person. Every one of them carries a cross. That line has been forming and growing for 2,000 years. Even this very hour, there will be those who will take up a cross, get in the line that leads to heaven. The question of this hour in this place is, are you in the profession? Are you in the procession? Are you in that line that leads to heaven? Someone says, I don't know if I want to carry a cross. That sounds hard. Someone else might say, I don't know that I want to carry a cross. That seems like it would be embarrassing. I'm not sure I want to be in that gray procession. Why would anybody want to be in a line of cross bearers? There are three reasons why, if you're not in the line this morning, we would urge you to make a decision to become a cross bearer. Jesus said, and if any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. Luke 9:23. There are three reasons why a person would consider being in that line. Why be a cross bearer? If you want a map of where we're going this morning, it's just those three simple words: love, debt, hope. Those reasons are sufficient to get into that line that leads to the one who carried the cross first for us. The first reason to carry a cross, to be in the gray procession, is emotionally, we are drawn to love the one who loved us first. Love is the most powerful force in the world. Love is more powerful than hate. Love is more powerful than fear. Love is more powerful than doubt. Love is the most powerful force in the world. Jesus loved us first. We love Him because He first loved us. 1 John 4:19. But God commendeth His love toward us, and that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Romans 5:9. When we did not care about God, perhaps when we did not even believe in God, when we were intent on enjoying the pleasures of sin, when we were, as it were, shaking our fists in the face of God or turning our backs and ignoring God, God said, I love them. I want them to be saved. Though there was nothing in us that was worthy of salvaging, there was nothing in us deserving of salvation, God said, I love them so much, I'm going to send my Son to die for them. And so Jesus came and He gave up His heavenly prerogatives. He came and lived as a man. He was born as a baby in a barn. He grew up as a boy unknown to those around him as to his true identity. He worked as a carpenter for most of his life, calluses on his hands, sore back, no doubt, after hard day's labor, many days. But finally, he closed up his carpenter shop, took down his shingle, and went around preaching in the various cities and villages of Galilee and Palestine. And there they heard words they had never heard. There they saw a life they had never seen. They saw Him do deeds that had never been done. They saw love as they had never seen it before. And crowds emptied of the cities and followed Him. They wanted to hear Him. They wanted to see Him. They wanted to know Him. They wanted to be His followers. And then the authorities learned of Him, jealous of Him, hated Him, eventually arrested Him, condemned Him, killed Him on Calvary's height. And there Jesus prayed even for His enemies, "Father, forgive them. They know not what they do." Even there He loved in the throes of utter physical, excruciating pain. Jesus cared more for others than He cared for Himself. And there Jesus willed Himself to die. "Father, into Thy hands I commend my spirit." And the greatest life ever lived came to a close, temporarily so. The only life ever lived that was without any fault, without any sin, that was perfect in every way, that was absolutely motivated and enacted by love, died. They took His body down limply. They placed it in a borrowed tomb. He was there about 36 hours, 3 days, 3 nights. He came out of that tomb a victor over death, a victor over sin, a victor over Satan, and there showed Himself alive by many infallible proofs to those who knew Him, ascended back to heaven, sat down at the right hand of God, and invited every one of us to come and to live with Him in heaven forever. That's love. And the Bible says, Jesus said, "And I, if I be lifted up, will draw all men unto me." John 12, 32. Now, how can we not be drawn to such love as that? How can we hear the story of the cross and yawn and say, "That doesn't interest me, that doesn't move me"? How can we say that He loved us, but it doesn't matter to me if I love Him? No. When we know of Jesus' love, it makes in us a response of love. I read that when Alexander the Great entered Persia in January of 330 B.C., he would go on to win that battle, although he was outnumbered by the Persians 2-1. And as they marched through that arid country, Alexander the Great did not ride on horseback, but he walked beside his men. Although there was a magnificent steed, of course, at his disposal, Alexander the Great did not drink water, although there was always water for the king. But because his men did not have water to drink, he refused to drink. Therefore, it is recorded there was not a man who complained as they marched, though they were tired, weary, thirsty, because they saw their leader was willing to endure what they were enduring. Behold, Alexander the Great. But he does not compare to the one that you and I are considering in this lesson, the one who stands at the head of this great procession, the one carrying his cross, because although Alexander the Great was a great military leader, he built his reputation on force, upon military strength. The one that we discuss today built his empire upon love, upon spiritual strength. And Jesus was tempted in all points like as we are. Hebrews 4:15, yet without sin. You see, Jesus showed us how to live. Jesus showed us how to love. And the first act of love in response to that love for us is picking up the cross. It is saying, "I'm going to deny myself. I'm going to take upon my shoulder the burdens of being a follower of King Jesus. What He did, I'm going to try to do. Where He walked, I'm going to try to walk. How He spoke is how I will try to speak. How He lived is how I will try to live. The love that He showed is the love that I want to show to the world." And so the first great act of love to the one who loved us is taking up that cross. Jesus said, "If you love me, keep my commandments." John 14, 15. Now sin is essentially self-assertion. Sin is saying, "I'm going to do what makes me happy. I'm going to do what pleases me. I'm going to do what I think is right." That's sin. It's self-assertion. But love is the opposite of sin in this respect. Love is self-surrender. Love says, the person, that the object of my love is more important than me. The object of my love's will is more important than mine. I will sacrifice for the one that I love. You see, you can't be a Christian without love. 1 Corinthians 13, 1 through 3, anything that we might do not motivated by love doesn't count. And one cannot love without being a giver. For God so loved the world that He gave. John 3, 16, you can't love without giving. And you can't be a Christian without loving. Therefore, Christianity is a sacrificial religion. And I sacrifice my own will to pick up the cross. I sacrifice my own life to give mine to Him. Sin does not so much have to be violently removed from the life of a sinner to become a Christian. No, it's more like a dead leaf that falls from a tree or a pine cone that has served its purpose and is knocked from the tree by the growth behind it. Sin is like that because the affection with which we held on to sin at one time no longer has the same influence in my life. It's like this. Here is a child, a little boy, maybe 3 or 4 years old, and he has a favorite teddy bear. He carries it everywhere he goes. He sleeps with it at night. If he ever accidentally misplaces it, nothing else can take place until everybody searches and finds that special toy, because that's important. Or it might be with a little girl, her doll. She loves it. She plays with it. She pampers it. And they cannot even imagine going through a day without this special toy. And if you tried to remove it from the child, there would be a violent altercation because there is an emotional attachment to it. But you let some time pass. The social circle begins to enlarge. And the little boy has other friends. He likes to go out in the yard or in the community and play football or basketball or hide and seek or whatever it is. And before long, you'll see that toy is left on the bed in the room. Nobody had to say anything. It's just that something else matters more. By and by, that toy is put in a closet or in a box in the attic because it really doesn't matter to the child anymore because he's outgrown it. That's the way it is with sin. In sin, I love sin. It seems to be the most important thing, but when I love Jesus, sin no longer has the same attraction. I'm not saying Christians are not attracted to sin or tempted to sin, but in those moments of temptation, my love for Jesus is waning, because if my love for Jesus is strong, the attraction of the world is weak. And any sacrifice that we might make for Christ because of our love for Him seems so small. It's like when Jacob loved Rachel. You may remember reading Genesis 29, 20. He had to work 7 years for her. That was the arrangement with her family for him to be able to marry her. And so he worked those 7 years. I mean, we're talking not sitting behind a desk somewhere answering phones. We're talking laboring in a field. We're talking ranch. We're talking animals. We're talking hot sun and long days. He worked 7 years, but it seemed as if only a few days for the love that he had for her. He loved her so much, thinking about her during the day, thinking about her, I'm a year closer now to being married than I was before. It just lightened the load. And when you and I love Jesus, the cross is not heavy. It's a privilege to be able to carry it for Him because He first carried the cross for us. We honor Jesus by carrying the cross. And He looks down from heaven and sees the hardships that His religion brings into our lives. And He says, look at how she loves me. She is going through all of that because she loves me. Look at how He loves me. Look at what He's given up to be a Christian. Oh, the love of the Christian to Christ is appreciated in the world beyond what we can see. Why would one take up a cross, get in that line, separate himself from the world emotionally, We are drawn to the one, drawn to love the one who loved us. But number two, intellectually, we see the logic of giving a life for a life. You know, in the Old Testament, there were some laws that may seem harsh to our ears, but they were on the books to prevent cruelty. Exodus 21, 24, and 25, under the old law of Moses, there was the rule of an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a hand for a hand, a foot for a foot, a burning for a burning, a wound for a wound, a stripe for a stripe. In other words, there was balance, there was fairness. If you got into a drunken fight with someone and knocked out his tooth, then the punishment for that was to lose your tooth. You put out his eye in a violent altercation, then that was the punishment. It was fair, it was balanced, it was an eye for an eye. The Old Testament, in a spiritual sense, did the same thing to teach men about religion. Because men sinned against God, they owed Him. And there was a debt that had to be paid. But God allowed for there to be a substitution. A life for a life, but it didn't have to be the sinner's life. He was allowed to take a lamb, the best lamb out of his flock, a male first year, without blemish or spot. Bring it, and that animal, he had to kill the animal himself. The priest caught the blood, but he killed the animal himself because that animal was taking his place. God allowed a substitute in the Old Testament system to show that the penalty had to be paid, but it did not have to be paid by the same person who was guilty of the violation of God's law. You also see it illustrated in Genesis 22 when God told Abraham to take, or Abram at this time, to take his son, his only son Isaac, up into the mountain that I will show thee of, and there offer him as a sacrifice. And Abraham doesn't quibble. Abraham does not disagree with God. He doesn't question God. He just goes to the place. He goes up the mountain and he takes Isaac and he puts him on the altar and he raises the knife. He's going to do what God said to do. He didn't understand it. Hebrews 11, referring back to that, says that in his mind he thought God would raise him back from the dead. That's how he had worked it out, but he was going to do what God said to do. God called out, had an angel call out, "Stop, Abraham, Abraham." And so he stopped. And there was a ram caught in the bushes behind. And that ram was substituted for the life of Isaac, a substitutionary sacrifice. That's called redemption. A price is paid, a person is redeemed. You come to the New Testament, you find that Christianity is a redemptive religion. Christianity is redemptive as a fact, as a doctrine, and as a life. 1 Corinthians 15, 1 through 4. It's redemptive as a fact because Jesus paid the price for us. It's redemptive as a doctrine because we die to self, we're buried in water, we're resurrected to walk in newness of life. Romans 6, 1 through 13. And it's redemptive as a life because we go about serving the one who died for us. If you wanted to go back a little bit to the why it had to be like that, Romans 3, 23 to 26 discusses what we might call the great dilemma of God. God loved man and wanted to save him. He wanted to be the justifier of man, as Paul expresses it in that text. But God is just, and justice demanded that sin had a price paid for it, and that sin could not enter heaven, and that a sinner could not save himself. So there was this great eternal struggle between the justice of God and God the justifier, these two things. God could not justify man in his sins, but if God justified man, he would not be just. And so there were these two sides of it. And the dilemma was solved when God sent His Son to be a man, to live among us, provided He never sinned. And Hebrews 4:15 says that He did not. Hebrews 7:26, He was holy, harmless, undefiled, separate from sinners. Jesus lived among us, but He never acted like us. He never said, did, or thought anything He shouldn't have said, done, or thought. He never left anything undone, unsaid, unthought that He should have said, done, said, or thought. Jesus lived a perfect life. Therefore, he could be a substitutionary sacrifice for us. And he was. He died in our place. Now, what does that mean as far as this great procession that we are discussing together? Well, Romans 12 touches on this. I could quote this to you, but I'm going to give you time to get there because I'd like for you to have the benefit of being able to read it in your Bible, maybe make a note there or commit it to memory, at least to have it reinforced not only with the ear but with the eye. So let's see this in Romans 12. Why would I join this procession of cross bearers? Because intellectually, I see the logic of giving my life for one who gave his life for me. And that's what's taught here in Romans 12, 1 and 2. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that ye present your bodies a living sacrifice. Now, those sacrifices that we talked about in the Old Testament, those were dead sacrifices. The benefit of their sacrifice was used up in the consuming of the life. The lamb died, the ram died. That was it. Burned. Sometimes they were allowed to take some of it and use it as a meal, sometimes not. But that was over. It was a dead sacrifice. It may be that you and I will ultimately end up a dead sacrifice, a martyr for the kingdom of heaven. But what he says here is something different, something that is in a way better, a living sacrifice. He died for me. I should have died. He took my place. Now I have come to understand that, to appreciate that. What is an appropriate response to somebody dying for you? Well, this text says, present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, that has to do with how we live that life, acceptable unto God. He's willing to accept that life of sacrifice as a response to the life that Jesus gave on the cross, which is your reasonable service. The word reasonable there could be translated logical. It makes sense. You know, Old Testament, one eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. That makes sense. New Testament, one life for one life, a trade. Now, we could never in any sense make up for the great debt that we owe Him. I mean, an innocent man dying for the guilty and us just living a life for Him, it doesn't equal, it doesn't ever cancel the debt in any way, but it's an appropriate response for it. It may be that we will be called upon and we should be willing to give our lives in sacrifice as a martyr. These very apostles that we read about in the New Testament and other Christians, in some cases, gave their lives. You have Stephen in Acts 7 stoned to death because he was a preacher of the gospel. You see it in Acts 12 when James is killed. Traditional history tells us that Philip and Peter were crucified for their faith, that James and Paul were beheaded for their faith, that Luke was hanged, that James the Less was beaten at 94 years of age and stoned to death. It may come to that. Revelation 2:10 says, be thou faithful unto death, and I will give you a crown of life, not until death, but unto death, even up to the point of and going through the doors of death, if that's what it takes. But until death is probably a more appropriate way to express what he's asking of most of us, is just to be faithful, just to give our lives to bear his cross until the end comes. Intellectually, we see the logic of giving a life for a life. Why would I get in that line? Because he took up the cross first for me. Number three, experientially, that has to do with our experience. We know that worthwhile things always come at a cost. You see successful people, you know they did not get there without effort. They did not get there without sacrifice. I mean, we have a lot of students in this assembly today. Some elementary, some high school, many college students. Let's just take college, for instance. These students have chosen to come to Jacksonville, Alabama, attend Jacksonville State University. They are pursuing a course of study that will end up with a certain degree in a field. How much will they invest over 4 or, in some cases, 5 or more years that they will be here? Some will spend $100,000 on an education, especially if they go on to a master's degree or a PhD. $100,000, that's an investment. How many hours will they spend in classroom instruction? Thousands. How many hours doing homework outside of class? Who knows? What about effort? What about energy? What about time? Well, all those tests, papers, presentations that they will make in various classes. I mean, it's a lot of work. Why would they do that? Why would they be willing to take 4 years out of a life or more and say, I'm going to just pursue this one piece of paper I can hang on my wall? Well, because they know that education is worth something to them. It will qualify them to enter into the workforce at a different level than they might be able to enter otherwise. Probably will pay for itself over time because of increased wages, because of the kind of job that they will be prepared to render to a company or to the government or to an institution. Or even if that's not the case, then they will be trained to be of service to humanity in a way they could not have been of service otherwise. And they will have great reward from being able to help others to learn or to heal their bodies or to prepare to do a service for them that is of value and is appreciated. You could illustrate in other ways. I'm not going to take time to do it, but a successful business, same thing. A professional, where it's a doctor, a lawyer, a dentist, a soldier, a fireman, a policeman. I mean, they don't enter into those professions and hang up that placard or sign up for that in that corporation or that company without having put forth a lot of effort to get there. Anything that's worthwhile comes at a cost. What about going to heaven? Is that worth anything? Living with God forever and in eternity, separated unto Him, without any devil, without any temptation, without any sorrow, without any suffering, without any problems. Is that worth anything to go to heaven? Not even to mention the alternative, which is to go to hell. Of course it's worth. Is it worth taking up a cross? You know, it's a cross and not a cushion He's asked us to bear. The cross is not made of feathers. The cross is not lined with velvet. You know, I was doing a little research. And there are several of these people who carry crosses across the country, literal crosses on their back. One man, at least at one time, was trying to go to all 50 states over a decade carrying a cross. Another was carrying a cross all the way from one side of the country to the others, some in shorter distances. But I noticed this picture. This man put a pad on his cross. I noticed in another picture that this man put a wheel on his cross. Make it just a little easier. Now, I think this is misguided because that's not what Jesus intended. But it just illustrated to me how that when we take on the cross, it's not something that is going to be without difficulty. But because it is so valuable to us, it's worth it. If you wanted to say it this way, you could say from the vantage point of self-interest. I mean, we've talked about love. That's not self-interest. We've talked about the debt that we owe. That's not self-interest. But here, let's just talk about self-interest. Is it worth it to go to heaven from my vantage point, just me? Yes, because we cannot go to heaven without bearing a cross. So we say, Lord, please put the cross on my back. I want to go to heaven. God gives grace equal to the task. And so the heavy cross we bear gives us greater grace, Romans 6:1-2, 1 Corinthians 10:13. And then number three, there is no crown without a cross. So Lord, please let me carry the cross. I want to wear the crown. I want to close with this illustration. I want you to imagine a homeless man in New York City on a back street. There pulls up beside him a limousine, rolls down the back window, the chauffeur driving, the owner of a very important business, successful, rich, powerful. He leans out the window and he calls the homeless man over and he says, "I want you to come and be my vice president. Just get in the car. I'll show you what to do." I'll pause the story for a minute, put ourselves in the story. You and I are the ones who spiritually are represented by that homeless person. I mean, there was nothing to attract God to us. We were not using our lives for anything that would be eternally useful. We were without a job. But he gave us everything when we had nothing. So he rolled down the window of his limousine, as it were, and said, "Come, I want to make you my vice president." But now let's go back to the story. And here's the man. He looks at the man in the limousine, and he sneers and says, "No, I don't think so." Why? I mean, I'm serious. Let me tell you about the job. It's an important job. You'll be respected by others. It comes with a great benefit package. I mean, you will be compensated well for your time. You will have a retirement plan. You will have a vacation, two vacations every year, and they're paid for. You have a company car to drive. You'll live in a nice community with the other executives from our company. You have a house that's already furnished. You just need to move in. I mean, all this is yours if you want it. And he laughs and says, "I don't want that. If I went with you, I'd have to leave what's familiar to me. I've been living on this street for 5 years. I'm very comfortable here, and I'd have to leave my grocery basket full of belongings behind. I mean, I've got some things in here I've been collecting for a while, and I don't want to leave them. And you know, I'd have to take on responsibility. I mean, it's hard to live on the street, but at least nobody expects anything out of me. I'll just stay here." So the man rolls up the window and the limo pulls away. And the homeless man spends another night in the cold, hungry and abandoned. That's a picture of every sinner who says to God, "No, I don't want to go to heaven. No, I don't want to pick up the cross. No, I don't want to be in the procession behind the one who bears the cross." How foolish, but how common for one to say no to Jesus. But that story doesn't end there. The man that was in the car did not randomly pick out that homeless man, but for many years searched him out, finally found him, for it was his own son from whom he had been estranged and who had ended up after one bad decision after another on that street. He wasn't only asking him, inviting him to be a vice president of his country, of his company. He was inviting him to be the heir of all that he possessed. That's what God is saying to you and me today. He's offering us a position in the kingdom. He's offering to put us to work in His vineyard. But far beyond that, He's saying, "Come and be my child. Be my son. Be my daughter. You can live with me in heaven. All that I have is yours." Will you get in the line? Will you come to Jesus to be baptized for the remission of your sins? Acts 8:35-40. To be restored to faithful service and to take up your cross and follow Him again. Will you come while we stand as we sing?